This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. For years, bees seem to be vanishing, but in a new twist, scientists are reporting a comeback. Is this good news for our pollinators, or is there more to this story? Joining me now to discuss this data and what it means are University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Entomology, Jonathan Larson. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for being here. And Binghamton University Assistant Professor of Biology, Eliza Grames. Thanks for being here, Eliza.
Thanks for having me.
Eliza, we've been hearing the Save the Bees rallying cry for so many years now. When and how did this concern for bees begin?
So the concern for bees began, well, decades ago, but especially in the early 2000s, where there was a lot of attention being paid to loss of colonies. So people were noticing with, you know, colony collapse disorder and other issues affecting colonies that people were really concerned about honeybees. Although actually often when you're talking to a conservation biologist, when we say save the bees, we're talking about native pollinators and the 4,000 or so native bees that we have in North America. But there's also been a big interest in protecting hives as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think most people do think of honeybees when they think of bees at all. Are there problems honeybees have been having? What's been going on with them?
So the honeybees are subject to all of the anthropogenic stressors that also affect our native pollinators. So they're, you know, faced with pesticides, loss of floral resources as land use is converted from grasslands into other uses, and also disease conditions. So when you put that many individuals into a hive, you can sometimes have increased spread of disease and pathogens because there's such high density. And so that's really been a concern from an agricultural perspective of how do we manage and sustain colonies when they're so important for pollination and so many crops.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, what have beekeepers been doing to address those problems with honeybees?
Sure. They've been trying to approach new techniques to try and control things like varroa mite, which is a growing concern amongst all beekeepers. They have been looking sort of inward and checking in on how they move hives from one state to another in order to sell their pollination services and making sure that they're not doing things that may harm their bees then. And then the beekeeping groups that I'm aware of are having big pushes to get new members to join up and to get new beekeepers out into the field. We've had a huge increase in urban beekeeping here in the United States over the last decade or so. And so I think we just have more people interested in honeybees, which is helping those bee numbers that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And Eliza, you were just talking about wild bees or native bees, and we've been talking about honeybees. Talk to us about the difference between those bees.
Yeah, so there are many differences. So first, when we're talking about honeybees, it's Apis mellifera, which is native to Europe and Africa. And it was brought over by settlers in the early 1600s for production of beeswax and honey, of course. But it's not native to North America. And so it's an introduced species and it's domesticated. So we're keeping honeybees alive in these hives. And they do provide, you know, essential pollination for many, many different crops. But they actually will only pollinate about 25% of native wildflowers. And so then that leaves 75% of wild plant species potentially unpollinated. Another one of the really interesting things about honeybees and pollination that's different from some of our native pollinators is that they aren't actually very efficient pollinators. And there are some forms of pollination that they can't do. So honeybees can't do buzz pollination. If you think about, you know, watching a bumblebee out on a flower, you might see it kind of shaking very, very vigorously. So that's a buzz pollination, which is really important for many different plants to actually release the pollen. And without it, if a honeybee came to the same plant, it wouldn't release the pollen. And so it's essentially taking the nectar resources without pollinating that species. And so that's one of the really big differences. And also thinking about in terms of the species diversity, I mean, honeybees are one species, they're one introduced non-native species, whereas we have over 4,000 described native bee species in North America, and there's about 20,000 globally. So there's a very big difference in terms of diversity.
And you were just talking about efficient pollinators. Are efficient pollinators kind of limited to native or wild bees, or are there other pollinators that are native to the U.S. that are efficient pollinators too?
There are so many things that are pollinators that we don't think of. So, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when you ask people about pollinators is honeybees or maybe other bees, or people will think about maybe the monarch butterfly. But there's a huge diversity of pollinators, and things that we don't think about quite as often or give as much credit to. So, for example, midges and flies and beetles. There's just a huge diversity of pollinators that all rely on having both access to floral resources and also nesting sites to be able to survive. And so there's a lot of credit due to flies, especially for their pollination services, that gets overlooked.
Yeah, people don't think of flies as friends, but they're out there doing their part. They're out there helping. So, Jonathan, what kind of native or wild pollinators do we see that are most common in northern Kentucky or in the greater Cincinnati region? Do you have a feel for that?
Sure. You would absolutely be looking for things like the wild native bumblebees that we have. They share some of that sociality that the honeybees have. So they have queens that are active right now, buzzing around in people's lawns, feeding on all of those different flowers that may be popping up. We have mining bees, which are small bees that mine down into the soil in order to construct their nests where they lay their eggs. We've got sweat bees. We've got all different kinds of hoverflies, as Dr. Grames was alluding to. We have just a plethora of bugs out there that are working their butts off to try and get the pollen from one plant to another.
Working their little bug butts off.
Eliza, right.
this recent census of agriculture found what's been reported as a record number of honeybees in the U.S., and that's kind of what got us interested in this whole conversation. What is the data telling us? What does that mean for our bees in the U.S. in general?
Yeah, so the data was pretty shocking in terms of the increase. Back in 2017, there was about 2.9 million colonies, and now it's up to 3.8 million. So it's been about a 30% increase in the number of bees included in the census of ag over just about 5 years. And so that's a pretty dramatic change. A lot of that is driven by both just increases in interest in beekeeping, as Dr. Luxton was saying, where we've seen a big growth in urban beekeeping, and also for demand for pollination services, as we've been losing native pollinators. So it really has been a very dramatic increase.
So, Jonathan, what does that mean? Does that mean our bee crisis is over, or we still have problems out there?
I wish that I could say the bee crisis was over. We always get these drips and drops of kind of good news and bad news, and it's always an ongoing fight. The problems that persist for pollinators are still out there. Urbanization, new diseases, new parasites, lack of floral resources, all of those things that we kind of heard a little bit about before. None of that's gone away. I think some people would really like for this to be a very simple problem. Maybe we ban one type of insecticide, or we do this one thing. You don't mow for the month of May. And then we help these bees out so much that all of these problems are erased. But it really is more systemic than that. We have to address all of the ways that we construct neighborhoods, the ways that we approach agriculture. I don't want to sound like a real downer, but even though we do have all of these bees that are being kept, it hasn't erased some of the deficits that we see. With honeybees, we're still losing lots of honeybees. Colonies do die out still, and beekeepers are reporting that. And then we still haven't fixed anything with the wild native bees, unfortunately.
Yeah, Eliza, my understanding is this census, you know, it showed this big increase in honeybees, but those are bees that are basically livestock, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I sometimes like to compare it to, if you were wondering how birds were doing on a global scale, you wouldn't include poultry farms. And so we're seeing essentially the same thing with the honeybees, where we're managing them, we're keeping them alive, we're keeping them keeping those numbers up because we use them as an agricultural resource. And so there's a ton of resources and money and energy funneled into boosting those numbers, but the same resources aren't available for native pollinators. And so that's where we're seeing the huge losses and declines from all of those different stressors. And you know, as Jonathan said, there's so much that needs to be done to address that issue. And it's not a single thing. There's no magic solution to the insect biodiversity crisis.
We're talking about whether bees are making a comeback and what we can do to support our pollinators. Well, let's continue our conversation. So, Eliza, do we have a handle on how wild bees are doing, how much at risk they are, how much loss there's been when it comes to wild or native bees?
Yeah, so one of the challenges with understanding sort of the rate of decline with wild pollinators is that there's been not as much historical data or knowing what was there historically that we've lost, but there have been some recent studies coming out. So there's been an estimate that there's 40% of bees globally are at risk, 28% of bumblebees are at risk. Really, very recently here in New York, the New York Natural Heritage Program did a statewide pollinator survey and found that 31% of bees within New York are at risk of extinction, and that there's 38% when you consider all of the pollinators they were looking at, not just the bees. So we really are looking at massive rates of decline, and it's very, very concerning.
Well, because you were talking about how much more efficient those native or wild pollinators are. But even with these honeybees, Jonathan, I mean, as I understand it, there are just huge truckloads of bees that move across the country to help pollinate almond crops in California. I mean, these bees are working hard, even these domesticated bees. What are the implications for humans if we don't get these bee problems figured out?
Yeah, things will definitely change at the grocery store. You might be looking mainly at corn and bread if we didn't have all of these pollinating insects. Some of those delicious foods that we enjoy, like blueberries, tomatoes, all of the different things that you grow in your garden for the most part, they need those pollinators' help in order to get to the final product. So it is a scary thing to think about. There are some places where you see hand pollination occur, where they get paintbrushes out and they move the pollen around themselves, as humans. That sounds like a lot of work, and probably not very fulfilling work at that. But if we do help the pollinators out, hopefully they'll keep doing this free labor for us, basically, these ecosystem services that they provide.
Eliza, Jonathan was just talking about, all these pollinators and how important they are to all the things we like to have in the grocery store and our gardens. And we are facing this global insect crisis. Some estimates out there have put it at 40% of insects in decline. What does that mean for us, just this big insect crisis that the world is facing?
Yeah, so we have been seeing this fairly consistently over about the last half century or so, that the estimated rates of decline are coming out at about 1 to 2% per year for terrestrial insects. This is a number we've seen from many different studies. There was one from Nature Preserves in Germany that came out several years ago, where they were finding, a 75% decline over the past 30 years, because those rates of decline, 1 to 2%, doesn't sound like that much, but it's per year and it compounds. And so that means you're losing, 10% of the insect biomass and potentially biodiversity every decade. So it's really very, very concerning in terms of their the importance of insects to ecosystems. So they're really the glue that's tethering together terrestrial and aquatic systems, providing so many ecosystem services, up in the billions of dollars every single year in terms of their pollination, and also serving as sort of food resources for so many other taxa. So when we're thinking about the broader biodiversity crisis that we're in right now, it's an insect biodiversity crisis, because they're about half of life on Earth, and so many things rely on them.
Sure. And Jonathan, it's not just the crops that we eat, right? I mean, insects are a part of the food chain for lots of animals. I mean, talk a little bit about how important they are to all kinds of life.
Yeah, insects are, it's hard to even imagine how important that they are. When we think about insects, or I talk a lot about insects across the state of Kentucky, people think of them as synonymous with the name pest, right? They don't think of insects as good things or things to preserve in many cases. We have some very hardline attitudes about bugs. And it's unfortunate because that has impacts on our desire for conservation. And it's hard to convince people that most insects are very neutral to people. We have this zero sum game kind of thinking when it comes to insects. Are they good? Or are they bad for people? Many of them are very neutral to us. Think of stoneflies. I hope nobody out there is sitting awake at night worrying about what's up with the stoneflies, what they're going to be doing next this coming summer. But they're very important food resources for a variety of organisms and semi-aquatic habitats. They need to be there. They are keystone pieces of all of these complex machines of life that we have living around us at all times. We're seeing this play out with the double brood emergence. I'm fielding all of these calls every day about how do we kill these cicadas? How do we stop the cicadas from coming out? And I struggle to answer some of those questions sometimes because I think of them as reminders that nature is still alive. And there are some things that are still beyond our control. It's not something that is easy to do, though. It's not easy to convince people that even if they don't pollinate, even if they don't provide predation services, that bug is here because it's alive. It's part of nature. It probably should be where it's at.
Sure. Well, the cicadas are just a big old buffet for the birds, right?
That's right. Yeah. And snakes and all kinds of other things. Even people, I find them quite delicious, especially when candied in mulberry.
Oh, my. Okay. We'll have to save that for another show. Cicada recipes. Maybe we'll have to have you back on. Eliza, talk about what else insects can help with. I mean, there's decaying matter. They can help with our gardens in various ways. I want to, you know, let's talk about insects as our friends, not our enemies.
Yeah, I have a colleague who jokes that if we didn't have insects, that the entire surface of the earth would just be covered in manure for the most part, because they're so important in terms of that recycling of matter, doing decomposition, transfer of nutrients. I think a lot about insects in terms of their role in food webs and the resources that they provide, for example, to insectivorous birds. A lot of people think about, you know, the connections between aerial insectivores, the things that are flying around like swallows, and how important insects are to them. But we don't think so much about how important insects are as a protein resource and a source of nitrogen during the breeding season for birds. So, you know, hummingbirds will catch insects, even though we usually think of them as foraging for nectar. They really rely on insects to raise chicks. And same thing for species that you might think of as being more granivorous, where they're eating seeds, but they'll still rely on insects during the breeding season. And so, yeah, they provide so many services and support ecosystems, but, you know, as Jonathan was saying, they also just deserve to exist for the sake of existing and being really incredible creatures. Insects are absolutely fascinating, and there's so many different things that we can learn from them, and just really be amazed by how much they do for us.
Yeah. What can we do to help them? I mean, these bugs are doing so much for us. I mean, Jonathan, what's the most helpful thing people can do in terms of what we could be planting, how we should be tending our gardens and landscapes?
Yeah, I'm happy to take a crack at that, and I hope Eliza will as well. But I do try to talk to folks about limiting the amount of space that you have that's dedicated solely to kind of monocultures like turf. Nobody has to get rid of their entire lawn. We have lawns for reasons, to keep soil in place and to keep the area cooler in the summer. And it's easy to maintain typically. But if you can replace a 6x6 area in your yard with a flowering garden that's just dedicated to providing floral resources to pollinating insects and to other organisms that need that nectar, you are doing quite a bit to help these things. It's something that you can buy seed packs that are designed for your area that will have a multitude of blooming plants inside. We don't want to commit to just one thing over all of the others, one flower, because bees emerge in staggered sort of groups, and we want flowering resources out throughout the summer in different shapes and sizes and colors because they all have different floral preferences. So that's just one thing I think would be very helpful for people to consider, is converting part of their landscape or putting more plants out there that are in bloom that will help some of these insects.
Yeah. What do you think, Eliza? I mean, I've heard that the kind of a little bit messier garden maybe is helpful for our insect friends.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The messier your backyard or your garden is, the better it is for insects, including, yeah, as Jonathan's saying, putting in wildflowers, and especially to make sure that those are native wildflowers to the region, because otherwise insects may not actually recognize them as being a food resource. About, I think, 1 in 5 bees really are host plant specialists, where they need specifically the native flowers from an area. One of my favorite things I like to tell people is to not mow their yard as often, because partly it's nice for us because we don't have to get out there and mow all the time, but it's also really, really good for insects. Similarly, not raking leaves as often in the fall, because that's really critical habitat for so many species. Limiting the use of insecticides, so only spraying when you really, really need to. This comes up especially with thinking about mosquitoes, where people will want to spray really, really broadly to reduce mosquitoes. And what you end up with is just the few species that really are dependent on humans. So you remove all the other species and you're left with only the ones that will come up and be kind of a nuisance. Whereas if you have all of the mosquitoes still around, then they'll be attracting predators. And so you'll actually have less of a chance of getting bitten when you're outside in your yard. And then another thing that I think is really important is thinking broadly about their whole life cycle and about providing nesting habitat. So it's, you know, absolutely important to have those floral resources out, but also to think about creating nest locations. So either putting out artificial nesting sites for things that will rely on stems, but also kind of digging up the soil and making it possible for those solitary ground nesting bees to really be in the soil and not have it collapse in around them is another easy thing that people can do in their backyards or in farmland.
Well, I've been talking with University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Entomology Jonathan Larson and Binghamton University Assistant Professor of Biology Eliza Grames. Thank you both so much for your time today. It's been fascinating.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.